Good morning, Connecticut, and to our friends across the Sound, it's Director of Public Affairs, John Vokette. Thanks for tuning in to Connoisseur Media's award-winning public affairs program for the people, bringing you the latest information to help address concerns in our communities tied to youth, the economy, public health and safety, aging, education, and the environment. This week, we're introducing the Connecticut Violence Intervention Program, or CTVIP. This nonprofit practices trauma-informed care and unconditional care with every youth they come in contact with, providing a one-stop shop for at-risk youth and generally at-risk victims of violence throughout the New Haven region. Then we're checking in with State Senator Tony Huang of the 28th District in Connecticut to discuss some of the most important outcomes from the 2023 General Assembly session, as well as some ideas that are still simmering and are likely to come up again in 2024. And we'll close replaying a late spring segment featuring a unique nonprofit called History. This organization hosts fun and educational tours, helping folks in Fairfield County show off or learn about styles of architecture, community development, and the events and people that shape these places. We'll be back with these segments and more on the award-winning For the People with me, John Vokette, right after this reminder from our friends at Acts for Ministry out of Waterbury. Through Friday, September 15th, Acts 4, a non-denominational nonprofit organization, is seeking donations of school uniforms and supplies for low-income children of all ages. These uniforms and supplies will be given free or at low cost to children throughout the greater Waterbury region during the organization's back-to-school swap and shop event. Donations can be received at Acts 4 Ministries base at 1713 Thomaston Avenue, Mondays, Tuesdays, and Fridays from 9 to 2, or if you'd like more information, you want to find out how to donate, or maybe even get your donations picked up, just go to acts4.org. That's A-C-T-S, the number 4.org. Well, as I was speaking with our guest this morning, Olivia Langley, over at the Connecticut Violence Intervention Program, before we turned on the microphone, I was saying, you know, in 30-plus years of doing this program, starting at the New Haven station that we're syndicated on, and now spreading to three interviews a week, 50 weeks a year, you'd think I may have accommodated all of the great service organizations, not just in Greater New Haven, but throughout the entire state that we serve here. But I'm always learning about new organizations, and so pleased to meet Olivia and to welcome the Connecticut Violence Intervention Program to the For the People world. This organization is a nonprofit in New Haven serving that community and surrounding communities, and they work with young people ages 13 to 24 who are impacted by or who are involved with violence. And Lord knows this is an organization that is very much needed these days. And I'm so pleased to be able to welcome Olivia and talk more about it so that all of our listeners and communities we serve can learn about it. Olivia, thank you so much for joining us today. And thanks for the work that you and your team are doing over there.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
So I understand you came to the program because you really want to be involved in disrupting, preventing, and stopping the spread of violence, as well as connecting to and helping to elevate young people that you're working with. Do you come from a youth or a counseling background?
Yes, so I actually went to school for criminal justice, and then in working and getting experience within the field, I was a victim advocate. So I worked on the other side, you know, supporting victims, working with children and families, getting them stable. But one thing that I did realize in doing that work was there was that other side, and they didn't see the effects of their behaviors and the crimes that they were committing on the victims. So what I always wanted to do was bring those two worlds together and figure out how we could, you know, do a common mediation and work together to figure out, you know, the best remedy let the people who are doing the crimes see the effects of what they're doing. And again, on the victim side, really just support that healing process.
So, you know, not to get deep into the weeds, but what can you tell us about the inception and, you know, the organization that is CTVIP? Has it been around a long time, maybe even with another name, or have the people that have been involved with the effort, you know, were they like loosely organized as a grassroots group that came together to make this nonprofit?
Absolutely. So there was another organization actually within the same building doing similar work. They were around since 2007, and CTVIP is a continuation of the previous organization that was doing the street outreach in New Haven, like I said, in the same building. So CTVIP was actually established in November of 2018, and we took the vision of the previous organization and, you know, added our own personal touch.
Mm. And you also smartly tapped templates that were proven successful already. I'm talking about the Cure Violence program in Chicago and Ceasefire up in Boston, right?
Absolutely. So we do work within those two models. We treat violence as a health epidemic. So such as a medical professional would treat the flu, us violence prevention professionals treat violence as a medical issue. So the first thing that we do is interrupt. So we, you know, get involved, ask questions, interrupt that violence on both ends, both parties, and then we reduce the risk. So either separation, a mediation, a conversation with both sides, and then just doing the education part. If a mediation is done, then that third piece would be following up to say, you know what, how can we do things differently? There is a cultural norm, you know, in the space that we work in, that violence is the answer. We want to change that norm to understand that it's not okay for us to pick up guns. It's not okay for us to use guns. So, you know, just getting the youth and adults, family members to understand that violence doesn't have to happen. And especially with the use of a gun is really important to us.
It's been said by other guests on this program over, especially over the past 5 to 10 years, that we're pretty lucky to be in Connecticut, where you sort of have a top down approach that sort of umbrellas organizations like yours and the work that you do. But not only are you operating in a state that kind of goes to bat for you in terms of legislation to help minimize the types of weapons that might be accessible to individuals that could cause harm in the greater New Haven area. But it looks like you guys also have a spectacular network of partnerships, including with a number of police organizations, and that's got to be able to help fast track the connection between CTVIP and the individuals who you're trying to, you know, sort of bring into the circle to be able to, you know, educate and to interrupt and to hopefully eventually change the course of the way they think.
Absolutely. So we work with a vast variety of different organizations, state, federal. We also work with the legislation, so we could go to them and say, you know, this is what our community needs exactly. And, you know, just hearing the voices of our youth to say, no, this is actually what I need versus what they're offering really makes a difference. So, you know, we do have oftentimes our VPPs, violence prevention professionals, speak up and, you know, they could communicate the needs of our youth. So that definitely holds a lot of weight.
I understand you also utilize a very tried and true formula of trauma-informed care when you're interacting with the youth that you bring into CTVIP.
Absolutely. So we try to have an unconditional approach. So regardless of, you know, what the youth has going on, we actually are redeveloping our plans for engagement. So instead of closing a case out because, hey, you know what, probation is done with the kid or the client or they're not responding, we understand that within the first 2 years, the first 6 months of that 2 years is just going to be finding that kid. and building that relationship. And once we do find that kid that we're, you know, trying to gauge or work in, regardless if they have probation involvement or any type of other services involved, our main focus is building that rapport with the child, with the families, and with their friend groups as well, because we don't just work with the clients, we work with the people around them.
That's great. Folks, if you're just joining us here this morning, where you've got Olivia Langley on the line, she's program manager at the Connecticut Violence Intervention Program. Aside from the great work that they're doing in the greater New Haven area, they've recently were notified of a delivery of a likely grant through the federal partners and Connecticut U.S. Senator Murphy and Blumenthal's offices of almost $300,000. For renovation at their own Ashman Street community building. We're going to talk a little bit about that in a couple of minutes. But before we do, Olivia, aside from the three components your organization is using to help reverse the epidemic outbreak of violence in New Haven, once you get through that sort of locating and intake process for the young people that you're dealing with, you then also apply a very comprehensive program to facilitate not just either getting back to or re-engaging with their schools and education. But there's also other assistance that's critically important, help possibly finding them work and even accessing mental health and support resources, or even law enforcement and judicial resources, right?
Absolutely. So we do a wide variety of things with our clients. The main thing is the case management. We also do cognitive behavioral therapy. So each time we're meeting with our clients, they don't understand the terminology that we're using because we're gearing it towards the way that our kids speak, but we're still implementing those skills and teaching those skills. So that's our biggest component. But we also, again, like you said, the employment readiness, court support. So we're not only going to meet with our clients, we're going to their court dates, we're visiting them in detention if they're in detention, in their programs. We do hospital responses as well. So those are just the small things that we do as far as the day-to-day. But we also have a whole preventative side as well with our juvenile review board program that is a diversion program. So in the elements that our clients may not fit the need for a VPP mentor, they will fit the need for our JRB program. So you know, as far as the range of neediness in the client, we could kind of base that on, you know, where they would fall with what program.
I also have to imagine that everything you could possibly do to help break down the resistance and the barriers to becoming immersed in the support and assistance that CTVIP provides, it also helps when there's a place for these young people to be able to go where they feel as comfortable as possible. And sometimes things like office buildings with offices and cubicles are not necessarily the most comfortable place to be able to expedite that transition and that sort of wrapping and welcoming that you guys do so well. And I guess that's where the community center comes in. What more could you tell us about the Ashman Street Community Building?
So Ashman Street is probably our most neutral neighborhood in New Haven. So that's why, you know, our services are mainly out of this building. But the purpose of us trying to build and, you know, the whole grant is to build that safe environment within CTVIP. We want our clients that we're serving to be able to come to CTVIP, our Ashman Street location, and just really feel safe. Once they come through that door, they don't have to worry about, you know, who's carrying a gun, who's not carrying a gun. The main purpose of us, you know, doing these renovations is to increase the safety of the building. You know, when people are coming in, they're getting patted down. We're making sure that no one has a gun on them, no one has a weapon on them. So even if they're coming from a different neighborhood, there's two kids from two different neighborhoods, we know, okay, well, this person definitely does not have a gun on them because our staff have done the things that they need to do to make sure that it's a safe environment. And we understand that there's going to be conflict, you know, and we're able to mediate those conflicts with our words and not, you know, with violence or anything along those lines.
So walk us, if you will, in the last few minutes that we have with you, Olivia, through the process in an example that's kind of generic, but mirrors examples of the kind of work you do. What would individuals who have been brought into the Connecticut Violence Intervention Program expect to experience in the first, second, and third stages of their connection with you folks?
Absolutely. So the first stage would be mainly relationship building, you know, building that relationship with the youth, getting them to understand, you know, within the first year to 2 years, we want to see that transition from the VPPs and their, you know, their mentors reaching out to them constantly, calling for appointments, things like that, to the youth calling us to schedule appointments, to want to come to the building, to really just coming to that safe place. So like I said, that first 2 years is really that relationship building, getting to know their support systems, building those support systems up. Although we are a long-term program, we understand that we as their VPPs cannot do the job alone. We're going to work with their parents. We're going to work with their aunties that they might be staying with, or, you know, their siblings, their friends groups. So we want to build those positive relationships around them as well. So like I said, you know, we're doing that one-on-one work with the youth, but we're also working with the families and building the families up as well. So that's within the first 2 years. The second 2 years is really just getting them stable, school, pro-social activity, maybe an employment readiness program, really just teaching them like this is a routine of life, right? And these are the things that can help you advance and become more stable. So they might start off with school or job court. We have a lot of relationships with other people in the community where we might refer to employment specialists, things like that. And once they are successful within that, we could say, all right, well, what does an apartment look like for you? But within that, we're also teaching skills like saving your money, opening a bank account, getting your license, you know, all of those things. Mm. So that's pretty much the next 2 years. And then we also have an additional 1 or 2 years after that, where we're kind of checking in with them. They're already successful if they get past those typical 4 years. After that fifth year is just, you know, check in. Mm-hmm. They may become, the goal is for them to become senior mentors where they can advocate and, you know, work with our younger guys who may have just got into the program and really just make that difference with them.
Well, it sounds like a fantastic cycle that starts out with the worst possible situation and eventually could bring that individual in just a period of a few years to the point where they are now community leaders who are reverting back to be support, part of the support network for the ones coming into your system who were just like them just a few years ago. That's got to be a real fantastic opportunity. Olivia, thank you so much for making us aware of all the great work being done at the Connecticut Violence Intervention Program. And serving Greater New Haven, they're providing trauma-informed care and unconditional care. With every youth they come in contact with, they're a one-stop shop for at-risk youth and generally at-risk victims of violence throughout the Greater New Haven region. Olivia, thank you so much for your time. Folks, if you'd like to learn more about this organization or maybe support them yourself, you can go to ctintervention.org. One of our great resources out of the state house is one of Connecticut senators. He serves the 28th district in Fairfield County. I'm talking about State Senator Tony Huang, a regular visitor to the award-winning For the People. Currently, Tony's serving as the ranking member of the Transportation and Insurance and Real Estate Committee. He's also a member of the Planning and Development Committee and the Finance Review and Bonding Committee, ranking member of the Bonding Subcommittee of that Finance Committee, and also serving as co-chair of the legislature's Bipartisan Bioscience Caucus. Tony, it sounds like a lot of, more kind of grassroots or in the weeds work that you're doing, but that's where it really all gets started. And we're sort of going to end the interview talking about how some of those seeds that were planted in 23 are going to get carried forward to 2024. But my understanding is that your goal and the goal that you hope to inspire among your colleagues in the legislature, first and foremost in 2023, was to really kind of drive a mission to help make Connecticut more affordable.
Thank you, John. It's an honor to be on your show, and truly, indeed, one of the biggest priorities I have as a legislator representing our communities is the fact that we need to make Connecticut more affordable, and we need to make it more affordable for residents and for businesses, and consideration and respect for future generations. But it needs to be balanced with the important goals of protecting our most vulnerable and at-risk population. And we need to address the issue of social equity and opportunity for everyone to succeed. And we need to address the short term right now, it seems, the challenges of environmental concerns of climate change. So I think so much of what we need to do in Connecticut is reflected on the mission and the goal of your program, For the People, because it really talks about for the people and what we do. And the criteria for me, some of the priorities that we talked earlier has been, how do we address the tax and spend policies of government to meet those needs of respecting for the taxpayers, but also addressing and balancing those critical needs. And for me, it really is about understanding what our role is. And our role is to provide critical services and infrastructure investments to provide a better Connecticut. But first, for us to do that in delivery of the services, we need to change government in regards to greater efficiency, greater responsiveness to the delivery of goods and services that people expect out of our government. And number two, equally important, is we need to provide access to quality education for every child in the state of Connecticut. What we have seen in the COVID pandemic is a significant learning loss, and it's a disparate re-entrenchment of achievement gap disparities that we have in this state. So for me, as an individual who was first generation, English as a second language learner, education has been a foundation of opportunity in the pursuit of the American dream. The third area for me that's a point of consideration is to ensure that we have a safe and stable environment in our communities related to public safety. Crime and violence has no place at all. And we need to balance that with regards to law enforcement, rules of law, gun control. These are aspects that relates as the umbrella of public safety. I think that the fourth criteria that I'm looking at is, how do we empower our businesses to succeed, sustain, and grow? And that entails workforce development, opportunities such as, apprenticeship programs, helping our small businesses in regards to rules and regulations and taxation. But I think the summation for me that kind of wraps everything around is the fact why I love your program's mission is it really is for the people. And I want to support individuals or groups in communities that respond to address these concerns as well. It's not a total dependency on government, but rather for us as a collaborative group, government, local authorities, communities, to be able to work together for the common good. Mm. And if I can do that as a basic theme for me as a legislator, is the divisiveness and the environment that we see on a national platform and sometimes creeping into the state platform, less relevant in our local. And I think maybe we can learn from that. Bipartisan and collaborative solutions are critical to move us forward to create a better Connecticut.
Yeah, well, maybe where the overlap between your work and my work happens is in being able to give a voice to the people and for the people. And there's a couple of things that are coming up that you and your colleagues are going to be doing to facilitate that. The first is the opportunity to be in a couple of weeks commenting on the pending increases in health insurance rates, the proposed increases. And then there's also something on the horizon that's coming up about the concern of creating a balance between combustion and gasoline vehicles, right?
Absolutely. In fact, next week, the 21st of August, there will be a public hearing held at the state capitol. It was moved from the insurance department office at my request to have a more public, transparent, and accessible opportunity for people to address the rate increases by our health insurance as it relates to small market and individuals. And we are looking at an average of about 14 to 18% increase to an already unsustainable and unaffordable rate increase for the past number of years. So August 21st is an opportunity for people to be able to voice their opinions. And I will be there in Hartford to advocate and to ask for a denial of these rate increases and greater accountability for cost containment. So that is on the front burner in regards to healthcare costs as it relates to affordability for consumers and businesses. Mm. The second, in regards to environmental concerns and the transition to air pollution concerns, climate change initiatives, is a Clean Air Act that was passed in the legislature this year that has very ambitious goals in regards to electric vehicles and kind of moving toward a non-fossil fuel transportation future. In 2035, the goal is to go to all electric cars. I supported the initiative because it is a goal that we must set to reach these kind of objectives. But I will dare say that it is also a very lofty and ambitious effort. We need to measure that goal with real practicalities of, again, affordability and concerns for the consumer, as well as our businesses, to make that kind of adoption. Look, 2035 is ambitious, but we need to have an assurance that the marketplace and the consumer is going to buy into it and be able to afford that transition. And we need to be sure that the infrastructure can accommodate. If we're struggling in our summer months to meet air conditioning and social needs in regards to energy consumption, how can you imagine adding that much more additional consumption of electric energy in our transportation to the electric grid? So you need to be practical. And the reality is, I supported the measure because goals need to be set. And without a goal, you could never reach objectives. But we need to balance it with respecting the impact of the marketplace. And the consumer and the marketplace should dictate it, not legislative fiat.
Yeah, the other voice that's coming out of that initiative is the folks who are saying, well, you're sort of plugging the tailpipes of the carbon emission producers in terms of vehicles on the road. But at the same time, are we not opening up situations where the power plants that we're going to need to generate all that extra electricity to charge and keep all these non-combustion vehicles on the road just going to kind of, shift the issue from 10,000 dangerous tailpipes to a couple of hundred dangerous smokestacks?
Well, that's the reality. And you just talked about the consumer marketplace adapting. Without that kind of connectivity, without that kind of symmetry to adoption, we're never going to reach those goals. So I think the reality is we need to set these goals, and I applaud the initiative, but government needs to be far more proactive in being a facilitator toward that. But ultimately, the marketplace has to make that decision. And if we don't make that adoption, then the reality is we still have a lot of work ahead of us. But I supported the measure because it is a goal that is noteworthy and needed. But nevertheless, the devil's in the details, and that's something that I'm going to focus and aspire to making sure that we don't implement or ideally legislate policies that create such a untenable burden and lead to failure of a very, very good idea.
Yeah,
because
looking before the world. Yeah, looking before we leap, hypothetically.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it's a tall ask, but nevertheless, I think we can do it, but it needs to be balanced with respect for the people and the initiatives in our businesses, but the affordability to do such a thing.
Sure. Let's leave it at that for just a moment, Senator Huang. We're going to take a quick break. Senator Tony Huang is with us, Connecticut's 28th Senate District Representative of Fairfield County. And we're going to be back to talk about education, as we introduced a little bit earlier in the conversation, and a little bit about public safety as we continue to hear these nightmare horror stories coming out almost by the hour now here in Connecticut. And also a little bit about how Senator Huang is going to work with his colleagues in changing Connecticut government's efficiency. We'll be back in just a minute. Stick with us. Hey, do you volunteer for or receive services from any of the hundreds of nonprofit agencies, community groups, and grassroots organizations in our region? Or maybe you're just looking for ways to help. If your favorite nonprofit is hosting a fundraiser or community building activity, or you'd like to find a nonprofit to support in your neighborhood, just go to our radio station website, hit the events tab, and find one, or discover some of the many causes supported by Connoisseur Media. I'm John Voquette, your public affairs director here at Connoisseur Media, and we'll be back to the award-winning For the People right after this news. If you work or volunteer for a nonprofit organization in Fairfield County, listen up. Impact Fairfield County is pleased to announce the next round of $100,000 grant opportunities for nonprofits reaching underserved populations and that highlight unmet needs in Fairfield County. The Impact Fairfield County grant will provide restricted funds to develop new programs, enhance, expand, or strengthen existing programs, and/or improve organizational capacity that advances the nonprofit organization's core mission. Potential applicants are encouraged to attend an applicant information session to be held on September 19th at Pequot Library in Southport. RSVP is required, however, and if you'd like more information, visit impactffc.org. We are back. If you just sort of joined us in process, the voice you hear is that of 28th District Senator Tony Huang of Connecticut and Fairfield County. He's a ranking member of the Transportation, Insurance, and Real Estate Committee, member of the Planning and Development Committee, and the Finance Review and Bonding Committee, where he's the ranking member on the Bonding Subcommittee. He's also a member and co-chair of the legislature's Bipartisan Bioscience Caucus. So, Tony, earlier in the program, we talked about education and the huge a blow that the pandemic kind of wreaked and how it sort of in some ways set us back a little bit here, if not a lot in the state. If you were to look at one single initiative you were most proud of supporting that was successful in the 23 session regarding education, just talk more about it for a minute.
Well, education is a foundation of opportunity and social equality. But we struggled as a state during the pandemic in regards to some of the regulations and the loss of learning. Even before then, John, Connecticut has the highest achievement gap disparity in social economics in the country. So I think one of the critical focus has to be educational opportunities for every child and every community. It uniquely in Connecticut, access to such an education for every child is in our Constitution. Now, when you talk about how we accomplish that, I think the reality has to be threefold. I think the first one needs to be we need to produce and support more teachers, quality teachers that reflect the community and the background ethnically, religiously, sure, of the students are teaching to
teachers
make that,
that
kind
look,
of
teachers social, that look like their students. Yep.
A sense of social connectedness.
Yeah, yeah.
I think the second part is to allocate proper funding to programs and make shortfalls that focus on achievement rather than simple bureaucracy. And I think that needs to go to the aspects of school choices, allowing parents to make determinations what is the best fit for their child, not state statutory requirements, to be able to support voucher systems for various different programs that may be available to cater to the uniqueness and the opportunities for every child. I think the third is to also recognize, and I think it was exacerbated during COVID, is the fact that the mental health support that is essential for every child as you go through adolescence and the changes and the rites of passages and the emotional tumult. Now you add in the social media barrage and the unreasonable expectations and challenges. Mental health needs to be a critical component of our education. It's not just reading, writing, and arithmetic as we have focused in the past, but it also needs to be balanced with social emotional dynamics. And we saw that through COVID and the loss of that we sometimes took for granted. So it's really important that when we make policy decisions, it isn't just simply looking to reach, quote, a goal or numbers and treating these children as numbers and data points, but rather to create an environment where every child and their unique opportunity and skill sets can achieve and succeed and develop a love of learning that will last a lifetime rather than an obstacle to meet to move on. So for me, education, there can't be anything more important. It has been the foundation for me to be able to do the things that I'm doing, and that is part of my gratitude in doing what I do to give back.
Well, as always, the time grows short with us at this point. Tony, I do want to take, if we could try to, box it into a couple of minutes about, public safety. This was another critically important initiative for you. And it really does seem that the period of COVID-19 created a lot of situations where a lot of people may have looked the other way when things were going bad, but it really seemed like a lot of things in regards to public safety turned a dangerous corner during and soon after COVID-19 had its onset.
Well, I think it's a multitude of factors, and it was unfortunately the perfect storm. You had a change in the police accountability bill, which, in my opinion, hampered our police to be able to do the necessary proactive work that are essential to maintaining public safety. I think the other is the exacerbation of COVID and the isolation, as well as the divide that we have in the boredom of our young people. And I think third, ultimately, is the proliferation of social media, TikTok and social media in some of these, follow pranks.
Yeah, glorifying the bad behavior, yeah.
But we also have experienced economic challenges for people as well. So I think for me, public safety and collaboration with law enforcement and community reinforcement, as well as family structure and stability, are essential. It's an delicate ecosystem in that regard. But I think the other critical thing that I have addressed is this. It's not simply addressing the crime and lock them up, but also trying to understand the underlying rationales that leads good people to make mistakes. And that segues into the very volatile and sometimes very controversial aspect of giving people second chances. Good people make mistakes. We need to create an environment and a correctional system and an opportunity for these individuals to move away from that kind of a lifestyle, that kind of behavior. But we have a responsibility to provide a better environment than some of those individuals have been in. So I look at crime and punishment and public safety intertwined in the sense that we have a role to ensure that a second chance is important. Now, most violent and dangerous criminals deserve to be locked up, but there are good people who make mistakes. So when you look at public safety, we need to provide programs, juvenile youth programs, alternative resources, after school programs to help support kids, mentor programs. So when I look at public safety, it's an ecosystem of understanding that we need to prevent it. But nevertheless, what are the foundations to causing those things that we need to clearly address as well?
Yeah, focus hard on fixing and plugging the dam, but making darn sure you got good sandbags ready to go.
Build a better alternative dam.
Sure, build a better dam. Well, we're down to the last minute or two, Tony. So I guess just a quick parting, a few words on your focus forward to the 2024 session, during which I know you said you were going to begin really trying to dig in on continuing to change and improve Connecticut's government efficiency.
John, I think the best model for us to never follow is the national political climate. The fact that we will have a presidential election coming up that is so corrosive, so toxic, and so divisive. We have a non-functioning Congress where people no longer represent the people, but instead identities and labels. So for me, if there's nothing else I do is to honor and respect the constituents of the 28th district and the people of the state of Connecticut, for us as policymakers to find solutions, not just one way or the highway, but in a bipartisan, collaborative way, because those are the best. The best compromises are one where people come away somewhat happy, but somewhat disappointed they didn't get all they want. It happens in real life. It happens in our household. But unfortunately, in the polarizing partisan politics that we have, in which national politics dictate what good people do, regardless of party labels, has kind of created that environment. It's creeping into our state and local governance. We need to move away from that. We need to judge people by what they do and collaboratively, bipartisanly, find solutions to help the people.
Good way to leave it, Tony. Thank you so much. Senator Tony Wong serves the 28th District of Fairfield County here in Connecticut. And always a great conversation, Tony, and learned a lot as always. Thank you so much for taking all the time this morning.
My honor and pleasure, and for the people, such a great title for your wonderful program.
So as we review the hundreds and hundreds of emails that come in to the award-winning For the People every week, a few weeks ago, I was interested to learn about a brand new nonprofit that is operating in Connecticut and helping to entertain and educate folks by providing a history experience, and that is with a T-O-U-R-Y. That's right. We're here with Allison Casaza. She is a tour production manager for History, H-I-S-T-O-U-R-Y, and they connect you to your past by creating tours in places that may be familiar to you because you drive by them or through them at 20 or 40 or 60 miles an hour every day, but you never really stop to think what kind of historical magic and points of interest reside there. So, Allison, thanks for joining us and giving us the lowdown on this organization. Appreciate you being with us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So, beyond the introduction, what are the basic few things that are most important for people to know about your organization?
Yeah, well, as you mentioned, our aim is to connect people with these historic places with the goal of promoting their appreciation and their preservation. We operate primarily in Fairfield County, Connecticut, Westchester County, New York as well, and other parts of Connecticut.
So we know you were in tour. You had recent tours in Stamford and Stratford. As you're beginning to explore new ideas and opportunities to expose folks to who come to your organization out of curiosity or because they have a specific interest in learning more about particular towns and cities, how do you kind of put these tours together? What kind of research goes into the background to do the work you do?
Yeah, sure. Well, first and foremost, we need to investigate, research what historic buildings are in any given community, figure out where specifically they are, get some information about their histories, the people that live there, when they were built, any other important events or people that have lived there, beyond when it was built. And then it comes down to crafting a tour that has a lot of great content in it. And, making sure logistical things. We do primarily bus tours, and we do have some walking tours. But with the bus tours, we have to make sure that we can, navigate to all these places. Mm-hmm. Sometimes these old roads can be a little bit tricky. But from start to finish, we utilize a lot of resources that the states have put out, that the historical societies have, and we'll also, utilize literature as well.
So the upside to taking advantage of history is that you create kind of in some way, shape, or form a thematic continuity. It's not just going to one museum or going to one site or going to one historical society. Some of these tours involve multiple stops, right?
Oh yes, absolutely. For example, a bus tour, we will drive by between 20 and 25 buildings. And along the way, as we're passing by, we'll point out, details about their architecture. And we'll also discuss their histories. And then we do coordinate several stops where the tour guests will get off the bus and we will tour interiors. This could be sometimes museums. But primarily we'll work with homeowners. So people get a really unique opportunity to see historic homes.
Oh, that sounds cool.
Up close.
Yeah. What is the proportion of locations on your tours that people might not otherwise be able to ever access or see versus sites that are fully or partially publicly accessible?
Sure. I would say it's 75% or
wow.
Upwards.
That's great.
Yeah. Yep.
So how do you identify and isolate? And then, this sounds like a lot of really important and interesting work, but, the phone call or the knock on the door to the next candidate location, that could be flattering to a property owner, but how do you talk them through it, or how do you learn more about which of these locations might be of particular interest to the folks who come on your tours?
Yeah, well, we're looking for places that have retain the historic detail. Obviously, when we're talking about a colonial home, you're not going to get something that looks 100% as it did back then. But, we do want to have a certain amount of those historic features visible inside the home. And then you're correct. It is an undertaking to find contact information for people and to do all of that outreach. But it's definitely worth it. And we think that it's something that the tour guests, enjoy the most out of the tours.
Hmm. And, I imagine that in some instances when an individual with a very unique site or home says yes, for this one time, then that might be the only chance that folks might ever get to see some of these beautiful locations. But while at the same time, I have to think that there's also some really good standbys that you try to utilize any time you're bringing a tour to a particular region or city.
Yeah, well, to that end, all of our tours are what we call one and done. So we're not going to repeat the same content over and over again. So really what we're asking for the homeowners is just to, open up their homes on one particular day.
Mm.
And also, this isn't an open house style.
As I
mentioned, it's a bus tour, so it's coordinated, and we spend about 20 minutes to a half an hour at each home. But yeah, it's really exciting for people to be able to see to see these spaces, and also it's neat to see. House museums are certainly great and valuable, but it's also very interesting to see, how people are living their modern lives in these historic homes. It's a neat blend.
Mm. Tours like this are most valuable when they are led by very engaged and educated guides. Let's talk a little bit about your team.
Sure. Well, we are continuing to develop our network of tour guides. We look for people that are either particularly knowledgeable in the local history, so perhaps they're affiliated with the local historical society, or they're the town historian, as we've had lead our Reading tour.
Mm.
We also look for people who have, perhaps backgrounds in architecture. As our tours kind of straddle both the architecture and the history, that leads us to looking for people that have backgrounds in either of those areas.
Mm-hmm. And for folks that like a little bit more personal freedom or flexibility, you can also help them too. I see that you arrange self-guided and driving and walking audio tours. Let's talk a little bit about that.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. Those are still in development, but we do have almost a dozen between Fairfield County and Westchester. So the self-guided tours utilize an app. And so we put into that app all of the, geographical coordinates for these locations. And as people are driving by or walking by, the audio content will automatically play. And it's very much, the same type of idea where we're discussing architecture as well as the histories of those places. And so those are really neat, as you mentioned, for people, who want to have some freedom and schedule these on their own time. Each of those are about an hour and a half in length. And so, yeah, it's a really great way to experience what we do if you can't make it to one of our tours or both.
So then in the last couple of minutes that we have, the only thing left to talk about is what's in store for the summer and fall with Histori. What can folks take advantage of, and what are some of the cool things they might be able to see if they book with you in June, July, or perhaps on into the later summer, early fall?
Sure. Well, we decided that the summer, at least for our first year, we are going to be extremely light with our tours, and we're going to have a very robust lineup in the fall. However, in the summer, we do have one tour. It is in Westchester. It's a tour in New Rochelle focusing on Tudor Revival style homes, which is really flourishing there. It's a great great representation of the architecture in that town.
Mm-hmm.
In Fairfield County in the fall, we have several that are being planned right now. We'll have a colonial theme tour in Ridgefield and a mid-century modern theme in Wilton. In the Westport area, we will have a tour that's focused on some really beautiful stone homes all built by an architect, Fraser Peters, who is really prominent in the area, and he had a really unique, unique style. So that's going to be really great. We'll have a tour in the Milford West Haven area. The theme for that is still in development. We will have in September a tour in Fairfield, Connecticut, and we're going to look at a lot of different styles and of buildings on that tour, but they are all linked in the sense that they're all on the National Register of Historic Places.
Fantastic.
Because
that's
of
great.
Their architectural and historic significance.
Very good.
Yeah, so that one's going to be neat. You'll get to kind of get a nice sample from colonial to 20th century buildings.
Lots of surprises and certainly a one-of-a-kind exclusive experiences in store whenever you participate with History. You can learn more about them at histoury.org. History. Learn about styles of architecture, community development, and the events and people that shaped the places that they go. Allison Casaza is a tour production manager for History. We hope that you'll take advantage of this interesting and relatively new nonprofit here in our region and learn more about the places we live. Thank you, Allison. You've been listening to our award-winning public affairs program for the people. The opinions expressed on this broadcast represent those of our guests and host. If you have a suggestion for an issue, a guest, or a PSA relevant to the audience and community served by our radio station, you must make a request for consideration in writing to me via email at john.voquette@connoisseurct.com. We do not accept pitches or requests for coverage by phone. Remember, no part of this program may be copied, disseminated, or rebroadcast. Our public file detailing the many critical community and state issues addressed on For the People can be reviewed upon request during normal business hours at 440 Wheeler's Farms Road in Milford or on our station website. Our theme music is by Rick Miller and Scott's, with original music by Noel Viette. I'm Director of Public Affairs, John Voquette. Join us again this time next week for more conversation and information on the award-winning For the People. And don't forget, you can listen to this and other For the People podcasts anytime on iTunes or under the podcast tab on our station's website. Until this time next week, thanks for listening.